Imagine that instead of cutting open a dead body to see how we're all constructed, that you could travel inside that body virtually, along with a teacher pointing out what you see, need to know, and could change. It's in 3D, it's in color, and it's far less icky. The New World is for medical students at Case Western Reserve and at select medical schools around the country, now using technology developed by Case, where professors applied 21st century technology to update ways some things have been done since the late 19th century. Now a new business has sprung up to advance its creations. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson, and I'll talk with the driving forces behind this new company, owned by the school, but destined to help people around the world. We'll also talk with a researcher who's been looking at the broader world of entrepreneurial businesses in Northeast Ohio, a far different landscape than what existed just a few years ago. But there's a disconnect in some areas, as the new faces of business don't always have the background and connections of their predecessors. He'll highlight what's changing. And we'll close the week with another episode of Shuffle, our music podcast. First, though, national and local news. It is the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. The entrepreneurial history of Northeast Ohio is a rich one. Think of names like Mather, Chisholm, Rockefeller, Brush, all notable entrepreneurs and business leaders, but from decades past. When business leaders and economists look at the entrepreneurial landscape of the region now, however, much has changed. The faces of those trying to start businesses look different, as we see more diversity in color and gender than the predominantly white male business of the past. Resources for those trying to start a business are also much different. Programs within civic organizations aim to provide financial and educational resources to up-and-coming business owners. But in a lot of cases, those resources remain out of reach or completely unknown. New reporting from IdeaStream Public Media is examining the entrepreneurial landscape in Northeast Ohio, and we'll discuss that at the top of the show today. Stick around, though, as later this hour we learn of a new business coming out of Case Western Reserve University where virtual and augmented reality are being used to rewrite how medical students are being taught. And finally today, another episode of our music podcast, Shuffle. First up, though, a conversation with Douglas Guth. He's a freelance writer and reporter who did some reporting on entrepreneurs in Northeast Ohio for IdeaStream Public Media. Doug, welcome to the Sound of Ideas.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin with what your inspiration was in deciding to profile the current entrepreneurial landscape here in Northeast Ohio.
Well, sure. You know, Northeast Ohio is a region of innovators and risk takers. It's just a matter of kind of connecting that tissue together. And that's something we have not always had. So that's something I wanted to explore through this story.
We think of the region, I think, as being tied to its history of manufacturing. Does that square with what sorts of businesses are being started here today?
Well, yeah, we're certainly seeing some of that connection in terms of that maker energy. But what we're seeing also is the Cleveland and the surrounding area building itself up as a technology hub, where entrepreneurs maybe even moving here or people from here are establishing these tech businesses. It could be around ed tech or, you know, health tech area or even fintech as well. So there is that manufacturing piece, but as I say, you're seeing this technology hub, though it's not entirely connected, you're seeing that growing here, you know, slowly but surely.
Mm-hmm. You reported in the IdeaStream story that one of the big hurdles in Northeast Ohio is connecting entrepreneurs with resources. What kind of resources are out there? What do they typically offer to somebody who's really on the ground floor?
Right. Well, we're seeing there are these groups out there. You have Greater Cleveland Partnership, Jumpstart, and Magnet, and that's just a few names that are here in the region that are connecting folks to economic development resources. And the big thing you're seeing now is pitch competitions, you know, across this landscape. You know, the Greater Cleveland Partnership has something called Chain Reaction, which is a neighborhood pitch competition where they're, you know, they themselves are connected to Jumpstart through that competition. It's kind of a boot camp where you know, people learn about from business experts and entrepreneur-friendly mentors. And people are not just getting, you know, cash prizes and being sent on their way. They're actually, you know, sitting down with seasoned business owners and getting advice, and hopefully that grows into future relationships and mentorships.
Are the people who are participating in Chain Reaction thrilled about the possibility, or is it just one more thing that they're trying to collect for themselves?
Well, I think that, you know, not having spoken to all those folks directly, I think they are excited about it. I mean, just hearing from GCP and the work that they're doing, I think I would have to source this, but I think they've been in their sixth or seventh year of doing this competition. And, you know, there are some growth around these businesses growing through the competition. So people are definitely, you know, thrilled to be a part of it.
I know you spoke to some folks in the area who are focused on linking entrepreneurs to the broader business community. One of those being Jessica Sublett. She's CEO of Akron's Bounce Innovation Hub. Let's listen a little bit to what she had to say.
We also need a little bit more connectivity to our business ecosystem. There are so many smart people that work across industries in Northeast Ohio who have probably a little bit of time to do some skills-based volunteering. And I think that if we could connect some of those dots and have some of these, you know, whether they're financial advisors or lawyers or HR professionals, people that work in marketing, sales, if we could connect some of those really strong industry people to our startups, that could be really impactful.
And you're saying that Bounce Innovation, I guess, sees these connections as a way for young businesses to, what, survive another recession, survive something unexpected like the pandemic, Doug?
I would say it's a combination of both. I mean, people are kind of battening down the hatches, and you know, through this work that Bounce and these other groups are doing, they're preparing people to, you know, get through the storm and, you know, hopefully come through on the other side of that.
Mm-hmm. You also spoke with Ethan Karp. He's with Magnet. We know them as the Manufacturing Growth Advocacy Network. He spoke to actually the networking that's needed by people who are thinking of starting a business. Here's Ethan.
If I were starting a product, I would say, who's an expert in that field? And I would go convince them to be an advisor to me, kind of put my board together. If it was a food product, I get somebody in the food industry. So I would network my way through Magnet or other to somebody who believes in me, believes in my product, and can give me that advice on the market.
Doug, I think that really goes to show the work and the ecosystem that needs to exist for these young entrepreneurs before their companies or their products or even out there being launched.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, right now, what is missing is on the venture capital side. And, you know, that's not something new, but these investments that startups need to succeed. You know, once again, we're looking at this looming recession. And, you know, folks in the VC world are going to be a little gun-shy this year about that. So, you know, it's a matter, once again, of getting these people through the storm, through these different economic development connections, and hopefully, you know, linking this ecosystem together.
We talk about getting through the storm. Were the venture capitalists able to do as well as they would have liked, or are there as many options now as there were, say, 2.5, 3 years ago?
I think that is something that's still in process, you know, especially because of the pandemic and what we're seeing now with, you know, potential recession. That's still to be determined.
Mm-hmm. I know a big focus of everything now is DEI, and a big piece of getting the communities of color and women into the entrepreneur scene is still being created. What did you find out about these communities, A, being left out, and B, being brought in?
Right, and that's something that is not necessarily new either. I mean, these communities are still facing historical barriers that they have been for decades, especially around, you know, once again, obtaining capital. You always hear stories about minority-owned businesses. An owner, you know, they're getting rejected from a loan application from a bank due to a lack of personal wealth. And the other issue you see there is limited business, or I should say, limited access to business networks, because there's not many minority-owned businesses being created all the time. You know, who are you going to be talking to when the pool is so shallow? Sort of the cyclical issue for folks. So it's a matter of these groups, you know, bringing in minority businesses to help. For example, you know, GCP has something called the Commit CLE initiative, which focuses directly on racial and ethnic minorities. You know, in terms of minority entrepreneurship, and they're bringing in folks through that program. And then you have Bounce is bringing in that population as well through their GROW program. That stands for Generating Real Opportunity and Wealth. And it's providing women and people of color kind of this idea generation and skills alongside mentorship and brand development assistance.
And just as the banks don't see the history with some of these new entrepreneurs, I imagine some of them don't necessarily trust the financial institutions.
I'm sure that's true as well. I mean, this is all, once again, we're looking at this recession forthcoming. I think they're just holding their breath until the storm passes. I would definitely agree with that.
Are there other specific barriers that stop persons of color and women specifically getting into entrepreneurship?
I think it just goes back to that historical issues in terms of networking and not having those connections in the first place, and, you know, lack of generational wealth, just everything that you always hear about. There's just connections are not there, and it's just a matter of growing those. And that's something that's going to take years, if not decades, here ahead.
Talk to me about the actual talent that we see developed in Northeast Ohio. What did you hear from businesses, from organizational leaders that you talked to about the quality of the entrepreneurs we're seeing here?
Well, I think they're excited about, you know, keeping this talented town. I mean, there's definitely this pockets of talent either here already or coming to school, whether at Case or BW or what have you here in Cleveland. And then maybe they're jetting off to the coasts or other larger cities for these opportunities. So what I'm hearing is that they, from these groups, they're trying to once again connect these talented individuals to organizations and economic development resources that will keep them in town. And that's just really the big thing. And we always hear for years about the brain drain. That's always almost become a cliche here in Northeast Ohio. So it's a matter of just that connection and keeping folks here who would otherwise leave.
You talked about Greater Cleveland Partnership, Jumpstart, Magnet, the others. Are there collaborative ways that they're working to try and get people to come to Cleveland or get people to stay in Cleveland?
Yes, I mean, that goes back to some of these pitch contests. Jumpstart and GCP are connected on the GCP pitch contest that we were talking about earlier, the chain reaction pitch contest. And they are always in touch with each other in terms of different partnerships and opportunities. So that communication is definitely there. It's just a matter of programming and putting all that together.
Great information. Douglas Goof's a freelance reporter who's worked with both Crane's Cleveland Business and Ideas from Public Media. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right here, but when we return, we'll talk about one new company that's got its start in Cleveland called Illumis, developed at Case Western Reserve University, and which focuses on holographic software that helps teach medical students about anatomy without using cadavers. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. We've been talking this hour about the region's entrepreneurial landscape and what it's like starting a company from scratch in Northeast Ohio. Now we're going to talk about one specific new startup called Illumis that got its start in our backyard at Case Western Reserve University's School of Medicine. The university developed pioneering hollow anatomy software that helps teach students about human anatomy without the cadavers using holographic imagery. Illumis aims to bring this mixed reality learning technique to students around the world. Software is already being used by hundreds of med students at Case and is licensed to more than 18 other institutions now. Here to tell us more about the development of this idea and what the future holds for holo technology is Dr. Mark Griswold, a professor in the School of Medicine and Faculty Director of Interactive Commons at Case Western Reserve University. He joins us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. By telephone, we have Mark Day, who's the CEO of Illumis. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And we also have with us Dr. Suzanne Wisch-Baratz, PhD, Associate Professor of Anatomy at Case. Thank you for calling in as well, Doctor.
My pleasure.
If you'd like to ask questions about teaching anatomy using holographic imagery or other applications for this technology, the number to call, 866-578-0903. You may email questions to soi@ideastream.org, or you may tweet us. We are @SoundOfIdeas. Mark, tell me first off what hollow anatomy software is and how this idea started back in 2014. You were looking really for a new way to teach students about anatomy.
Yeah, the university was building a new health education campus that is now, you know, on the campus of the Cleveland Clinic. And as part of that, they wanted to find a way to teach without building a new cadaver lab. And when you look out in the world, there's enough digital technology out there, and we have images of the human body, and we thought this would be simple, and it actually was really, really hard. And so we went out and found, through some connections with Microsoft, this technology called a Microsoft HoloLens, which is a headset that you wear on your head, and it's a transparent visor that uses lasers to project 3D images onto your retina that you see as 3D objects in the real world. And we saw that and immediately knew that we could change the way that we teach and use this to make our holographic anatomy mm-hmm. program.
I read that when you were ushered into the super secret Microsoft back room that you saw this technology and actually had to sit down. You were so stunned because you knew your world had just changed.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that you see for the first time and your heart stops because we're not used to seeing digital things in our world. And they become these things that are real. Just yesterday, I was doing a demonstration with our new vice president for research, and we had to go fast, and we put the headset on him, and we were doing an anatomy demo. And I always ask people to go from one side of the body to the other. And there's a human body that's full scale, that's a hologram, that's standing in front of you. And we've done this with thousands of people. They always walk around the body. even though it's only, you know, they've seen this thing for less than a minute, they already believe that it's real, mm-hmm. that it's in the room, and that you basically have to be a sociopath to walk through it, even though it's just made out of light. And so there's this realism, this visceral connection that people have with this digital material that just doesn't exist anywhere else.
Mark Day, you were with Microsoft at the time. Give us the backstory, how long this type of a hologram was in production in the minds of your engineers out there.
Yes. It's what, a 7 or 8 year journey. Microsoft was really on to a new metaphor for computing. They were seeking to try to create sort of the next wave of ubiquity within computing. So starting with mainframes and then moving to PCs and then moving to mobile. And, Microsoft's been known as being kind of a fast follower, but in this case, this was truly something innovative that they had come up with on their own. Just imagine having a kind of a Windows PC on your head. So fortunately, the team with Mark and Sue and the Interactive Commons team with Aaron Henninger all just gathered around, got excited, and said, wow, we can really revolutionize the whole state of medical education with this type of technology. So thanks, Mark, for making it real.
He said earlier, and I'm talking to Mark Day now, Mark G said earlier that it projects onto your eyeball. There's no screen. This is actually projected into your head?
Well, it's a series of different cameras that are looking out and looking in. So the cameras looking in are looking at where are your eyes looking, and then the cameras looking out are trying to make an approximation of the physical space that the device is looking at so that it can project a hologram into the physical space and anchor it to the real world so that it is totally believable.
I'm fascinated. Suzanne, learning anatomy using cadavers is what we've always done in med school for, you know, more than 100 years. Why change things up now? Does virtual reality truly make it that much better for the student?
Well, our research has shown that this, what we actually call it mixed reality, and I emphasize that because virtual reality isolates you. It puts you in your own space in a different world. And we believe that medicine is a team activity. So it's very important to understand that the hologram is in the room and our medical students are working as teams to learn the material. And so in answer to your question as to, you know, why, I mean, by using Holo Anatomy, we are able to save time. And what I like to say is we have been able to bring anatomy to life and add clinical applications that our students need for their third-year rotations, for their clinical rotations, for their fourth year, and for their residencies and practicing as practicing physicians. And I'll explain what I mean. Our students, we found through our research, save a lot of time by using Holo Anatomy. And as such, in the same amount of time we used to use only for cadaveric dissection, we can now include radiology. In other words, students can look at the images and learn how to order and understand what normal anatomy appears to be on imaging. And we have standardized patients who are actors who come in, and our students learn how to lay hands, how to feel, for example, the thyroid gland. They learn it on Holo Anatomy, and then they learn to examine it in the same anatomy class on living, breathing people. A cadaver is not a living, breathing person. Furthermore, we use ultrasound, which has been known as the stethoscope of the 21st century, to learn what the anatomy looks like, again, on a living, breathing person, because we use it on our standardized patients, in real time. So in a single anatomy class, we are able to learn the anatomy on the HoloLens, learn what tests to order and how to view it on imaging, and how to examine it and view it on both ultrasound and on a living, breathing person by laying hands.
So are we making doctors faster, or are we making better doctors?
In my opinion, we're making better doctors. We're not making doctors faster because we are just adding what I like to call 21st century physician skills to our anatomy classroom. So instead of just looking inside a cadaver, we are looking at what does that anatomy look like when we are treating a living patient, and what tests do we order in order to see these structures in the clinic.
Mark Griswold and I were talking earlier about the fact that this is hard to describe on the radio, but you were saying that some people in Greater Cleveland have had the opportunity to actually see the lens because it was at the museum last year.
Yeah, exactly. Our group also did the mixed reality component of the Revealing Krishna exhibit that closed almost a year ago at the Cleveland Museum of Art. This was the Cambodian sculpture that it has been in the galleries for 50 years. And that exhibit showed the reconstruction of that. And as a part of that, the middle third of that exhibit, I would say it was the mixed reality storytelling of the history of that sculpture and how it got here.
No reports of people having any trouble understanding the technology?
No. We actually had people go through, and the most important part for me was that people were having an emotional connection with this story. You know, we had people coming out in tears at the end of the exhibit, of the mixed reality part, those that remember that went through it, was in a cave where this sculpture was originally in Cambodia. And we had people leaving that experience in tears and emotional. And if you think about it, it was just a hologram. It wasn't real. And they hadn't actually even seen the real sculpture yet. That was around the corner. And so that just told us this is a powerful technology that can really impact people deep in, you know, their selves. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to bring to our students to improve education, to improve our ability to communicate these complex topics.
If you're listening and you've seen that exhibit, or if you've had other reasons to deal with hologram technology, give us a call. You can ask questions or talk about it. 866-578-0903. Mark and Suzanne all here to answer your questions or to explain more fully if you do have questions. Now, to get back to the business of it, though, Mark Griswold, how did the Interactive Commons play into development of this Hollow Anatomy software?
So we were charged with the university to, at the beginning, just make it for our medical students. But we pretty quickly realized that this was something that other universities and schools could use throughout the world. And we started thinking about how to commercialize this. And when we finished the package as a whole, starting in 2018 and 19, we were being contacted by other people. And we started working with them internally, trying to essentially run a little company out of the Interactive Commons. That got to be so kind of such a burden that we actually hired a sales consultant, Nancy Farrow, who took that job on in January 2020, just before the pandemic. And then
timing is everything.
Timing is everything. So we started getting contacted by more and more universities trying to do this. And it just became clear that it was bigger than what we could handle inside a university.
So talk to me about how you developed this into reality to turn it into a business. What all was involved?
Well, the first thing we had to do was create the anatomy. There was no anatomy. And it was an enormous undertaking. And one, to be honest, that at the beginning I was pretty skeptical about. Fortunately, Mark is quite the visionary, and he was patient with me. I was terrified. And he worked with me to create one structure first, and then one system, and then another system, and then another system, until we finally had this remarkable product. And the cost of a cadaveric dissection lab is really, really great, both to create it and to maintain it. And so,
could you explain for listeners what that was, a cadaveric dissection?
Dissection lab. A dissection lab where, you know, a cadaver is a essentially the body of a deceased individual, and that's how traditionally medical, dental, and other medical professional students have learned anatomy. But to maintain this kind of space requires, number one, some fairly toxic chemicals, and number two, a lot of ventilation, and not to mention body donors and preparation of these bodies, which is a very, very costly enterprise. And many schools, especially now, understand that you don't need, our research has shown that you don't need to have a cadaver to teach anatomy. Our students are learning anatomy equally well, if not better, on hollow anatomy.
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, that.
Mark Day, the program comes with digital 3D anatomy art assets, it says. 8,500 illustrations of the human body? That's where I guess a cadaver can't possibly compete.
Well, and more as needed. What's great is that this application is a platform for medical education. So while Mark and the Interactive Commons team and Sue have come up with a baseline here with the Hollow Anatomy software suite, we now have Enuro Anatomy, things you can't even see in a cadaver, I'm sure Sue could confirm and Mark could confirm. But then, you know, what else lies ahead? So pathology, physiology, all manner of different medical education content areas that we can easily try to build. And now that the team at Case Western Reserve has done the hard work of carving out that first library of assets, it gets a lot easier. The technologies are becoming much easier and much more accessible from a training standpoint to get the coders, developers, and anatomists to where I think we can rapidly scale this up. And that's part of why we're spinning this thing out of the university so that we can get the resourcing that we need and move quickly to try to provide those other areas of medical content.
What other schools have jumped on? Where else is this happening? I mean, you don't need the whole list, but just an idea.
Yeah. Well, more recently, we've got Texas Christian University. We've got Northwestern University. It's kind of runs the gamut. It's really interesting. It's not just medical colleges either. It's any professional secondary or higher education program where there's a need to learn human anatomy and do it in the most sort of efficacious way possible and in a way that, as Mark started out, that is sort of, you know, native to the way in which young people will tend to learn in the digital age. So I think we've created something highly approachable here that I only wish I had access to this type of technology when I was coming up in the world.
Sure. Sure. Sue, how do students feel about using the holograms rather than the cadavers? Does it take away some of the, I don't know, real-world training they think they would get?
Well, we do still have a two-week dissection boot camp at the beginning of our course. So our students do get it, and we do offer a graduate dissection course for students who feel that they want it. But the truth of the matter is that our students are learning the anatomy, and that's what they care about. They want to know the material, and because what they really want to do is get in the clinics and get their hands on, you know, patients and begin to be doctors, this they seem to like it. And also, to be perfectly honest, they know when they come here what our curriculum is. I'm part of the admissions committee, and we have a huge applicant pool, so clearly people are interested.
Great, thank you. SOI at ideastream.org. If you have a question, you want to email it, or 866-578-0903. Mike is on the line from Worcester. He's called in. Good morning, Mike. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas.
Hi. Just had a couple questions. Yesterday, I believe, Microsoft announced that they'd fired the entire team behind all mixed reality, virtual reality, all their teams at Microsoft. So what does that mean for the future of this program? And are there any other Microsoft competitors, for lack of a better word, that are in that space as well that you could jump to should Microsoft completely abandon HoloLens?
Thanks for the question, Mike. Mark is the Microsoft alum here. Obviously you had to be kind of upset when you heard that too.
Well, certainly, we watch everything that happens at Microsoft as closely as we can, and I'm on the outside now, so I only read what you all read, probably in the press. But I will tell you that, firstly, it's important to understand what happened at Microsoft. There were two specific teams, pretty small teams, who were disbanded. One was this thing called the Mixed Reality Toolkit, which was a joint venture with Unity. That particular toolkit has been a wonderful work in development that I think we're at a place in maturity now with the tech where we don't need necessarily to do these things. So Microsoft is basically retooling their mixed reality to focus on more productive means. That was more of an experimental group around the mixed reality toolkit. The second was with an application, the name escapes me, but Yeah, thank you. AltSpace VR, which was also a team that had been in the works for quite some time, is actually really focused on VR, not really focused on mixed reality per se, even though it rolled up into that team. It's actually a very, very, very small number of people, sadly, but in relationship to the thousands of people, or hundreds if not thousands of people, who still work on the mixed reality hardware program, And are still working on a number of different applications internally, such as a couple of products they have that are tied back to Teams. One's called Guides and the other one's called Remote Assist. So there's actually quite a number of people that are still working in mixed reality. And mixed reality remains one of the company's top priorities. Look, they've created a new category here for computing, and they have a huge contract with the Pentagon that they're actually making significant progress with right now. So I don't see Microsoft getting out of the mixed reality game, that's my opinion, anytime soon. The good news is on the second part of the caller's question is there are a number of great hardware vendors that are really coming up quickly. And despite how long it's taking, because this stuff is hard to do, and it's quite expensive. It's quite capitally expensive to build these headsets. But Apple and Meta and a number of other companies are really coming forward quickly with some new innovations. And fortunately for us, Dr. Griswold and team have architected this application to where we can easily take advantage of those other endpoints as they come into the arena with, you know, new technologies, but still using a standard that is more open source oriented. So we're pretty stoked about what the future holds.
Hope that answers your question, Mike. We did not ambush Mr. Day. We had him scheduled long before Microsoft came up with that. Thank you. You just touched on something, though, while you were talking about the expense. And I had an email from Robin out in South Russell who wanted to know how expensive the technology is.
Well, it's, I should say, you know, it's still a fairly nascent category, so it is, I would call it premium priced, if you will, but it's coming down pretty rapidly. Microsoft's been selling the HoloLens for about $3,500. They started at $5,000 with version one. The new Meta device is, what, $1,600. There's talk of Apple's device getting at $3,000 or lower. So you can see that the cost of the hardware is definitely coming down, and I think we're starting to hit that inflection point with innovation on the hardware manufacturing. On the software side, that's actually the part that can be a lot more expensive, but that's where the value lies. And I don't know what price you put on the fact that if we can help students learn twice as fast and retain significantly more information for a lot longer, and then also gain access to potential new research grants and attract better students. All those things, I think, add up to significant dollars over time, not to mention the fact that we see schools now who are either saying, you know what, we don't need a cadaver lab, as Sue pointed out, for purposes of teaching human anatomy. That can be a tremendous cost savings as well. So at least when you talk to any one of our customers across the 18 different universities that we're working with today, they'll tell you that the cost equation is quite clear in the amount of money and time that it's saving and obviously the pedagogical benefit that it's creating for students.
Go ahead.
Sorry, if I could just add to that. We think that this is going to be technology that's going to be used far beyond just anatomy. So we at Case Western Reserve University are looking at all the different ways that we can teach across our whole campus, whether it's art history or economics. And so that hardware purchase that you're doing up front is expensive, but when you can use that in 20 or 30 classes, it starts to even that out quite a bit. And so when we look out into the future, you know, we do really see this as the future of education on campus.
We were talking about the new company, Illumis, from Case Western Reserve University, working on hollow anatomy. We're going to be talking for a few more minutes. You can still call in, 866-578-0903. Guests are Mark Day, who's the CEO of the new company, Suzanne Wish-Baratz, who's an associate professor of anatomy at Case, and Mark Griswold, who is a professor in the School of Medicine and faculty director of Interactive Commons at Case. Suzanne had a question come in that you touched on earlier, but a doctor by the name of Jill writes in to say, she was a physician who did med school about 25 years ago. Learning anatomy through holograms sounds great, she writes, but my one concern is that our anatomy class also introduced us to the idea of surgery, knowing how things feel, the channels and planes within the body. You touched on it, but she says, how do you replicate that?
Well, first of all, it's important for me to begin by saying that a cadaver does not feel like a real patient. And the way we address this is through our living anatomy course. Again, because we save so much time with hollow anatomy, we've been able, as I mentioned, to include the radiology and the ultrasound and physical exam skills in an anatomy class. So every anatomy class, students lay hands on living, breathing people, which feel a lot more like surgical patients than a cadaver does. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we have never emphasized surgical skills in our dissection course. We've just focused on the anatomy itself, because surgery is, especially in the 21st century, is so much more complex and often laparoscopic. And so we actually have never taught and emphasized that at Case Western Reserve, or quite frankly, I've taught at two other medical schools and in those programs as well. So that hasn't been a focus in medical anatomy to the best of my knowledge.
Thank you. I want to grab some of these other calls. John is on the line this morning. John, welcome to the Sound of Ideas. It simply says you're in Ohio.
Yes, I'm a former retired worker from Lockheed Martin. And we had a contract only 8 years ago for developing a synthetic laparoscopy capability using what we called augmented reality, where they would use laparoscopic equipment but put virtually image into the laparoscopy so the student could actually do an operation, see the actual image he would see. Is this part of your program?
So we're working on similar kind of technology like that, but not that exactly right now. You use the term augmented reality, and this is a term that people have heard, and we've been using this term mixed reality. Maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about those differences. So in my mind, augmented reality is the broader thing of superimposing digital information into the real world. But this also includes things like Pokemon Go, if you've played that. You know, that's on a 2D screen superimposing, a Pokemon on the real world. When we're talking about mixed reality, this is, I would say, a form of augmented reality, but you're really seeing 3D holograms in the real world. And that's, you know, the powerful technology that we're primarily focused on. So the augmented reality that the caller's discussing is more of the kind of conventional kind, also very powerful, not core to our program right now, but things that we're looking at.
Thanks for that. Got an email from Rosie who says, it took an act of Congress back in the 1990s to include women in medical research. Question she concludes with is, will women's images be included in the software?
I can answer that. Right now we have both a complete male and female anatomy. And we obviously will keep doing that. And as we move into more disease processes and similar topics, we're going to be definitely focused on both genders for that.
Okay. Squeeze in one more call. Let's go out to Shaker Heights where Paul's on the line. Good morning. Welcome. Keep it quick for me, can you?
This is Paul and Mark. It's Paul Iverson. You had mentioned that we're using HoloLens for other applications besides holoanatomy, and I just wanted the audience to know that, we're using them in classics courses and history courses and art history.
Okay, thanks for the input. Appreciate that. I got to cut it short. I could talk about this all day, but I got to let you go. Dr. Mark Griswold, CEO Mark Day, and Dr. Suzanne Wishbaratz from Case, and from Illumis. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break and then come back with another episode of our music podcast, Shuffle. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for spending your hour with us. Time now for another edition of our music podcast, Shuffle, which highlights independent musicians across the region. You can hear installments Thursdays on Morning Edition every other Thursday here on The Sound of Ideas. Today we hear from a popular voice in Cleveland's indie rock scene launching the next chapter of her career as a pop star. On this week's Shuffle, IdeaStream Public Media's Amanda Rabinowitz has more on Shayla Hope's musical journey, which also includes pressing records in Cleveland and creating a theme for the Care Bears TV show.
I've got two tickets to the show you're putting on.
For much of the last decade, Shayla Hope fronted popular indie rock bands in Cleveland, notably Seafair, which headlined several festivals in Cleveland, including Bright Winter in 2018. The following year, the band broke up when Hope turned her focus to her lifelong passion, creating solo pop music.
A lot of people don't like backing tracks. They don't like major production. And so that's why I think it took me so long to be like, okay, I really want to make pop, because I was so worried of how I was going to be treated here. And it took gaining confidence and belief in myself to actually want to jump at it.
After spending 9 months at Suma Recording in Painesville during the height of the pandemic, Shayla Hope released her debut album, Damn Feelings, late last year. It's a synth-filled journey of love, loss, and heartbreak.
I really wanted it to be big and bold and like smack you in the face in the most loving way possible.
I know that it's kind of a nod going back to your early days. You were a drag performer.
I was.
At Bounce in Cleveland, which is no longer there.
Dude, it was a total Flashdance moment, which I didn't realize until much later. I was a machinist by day, and then I'd go at night to do drag, so I'd still have glitter on my face the next morning, you know, running like a huge lathe. Drag is what brought me into myself, 100%. I felt very closeted before, and coming out and being able to be my full unapologetic self was something I'd never experienced before without, you know, looks, and walking in there was like a totally different feeling. And yeah, pop got me through so much.
In 2019, you recorded the opening theme to the reboot of the animated TV kid series Care Bears Unlock the Magic, the, you know, Care Bears originating at American Greetings in Cleveland. That was kind of like the precursor to this new era.
So I got a call from my producer at the time, and he said, can you learn this song by the end of today? And it was for, I'm like in one of the Care Bears toys, like I'm in like a group of Care Bear toys. And so it was a song for that. And I didn't know they were going in a toy at a time, but I was like, oh my, trying to learn it. And then right as the day ended, my producer's like, he might want you to take a stab at the theme song if he likes your voice. Do you want to do it? And I was like, yeah. So I think that's one of the reasons this pop thing actually made more sense to me as well, is because it's the Care Bears Unlock the Magic stuff is very like 80s pop, and it's very referential to that time, which I love. Like my whole album's like referential. Yeah. Getting in there and being able to sing that and hearing my voice on something like that was like, oh, okay, I think I can do this. What a cool fun thing, and I'm still singing for them. I'm done with being so low, sick and tired.
You touched on it, just how long you spent recording this album, Damn Feelings.
Yes.
It shows, because this album is intricate. Talk about this recording process as opposed to recording an album like you did with Seafair.
Oh my gosh. I mean, there were days where we literally just recorded sounds. I think there's like horses, there are dogs, there are like slamming doors and airplanes on this thing. Like, we did not shy away. So yeah, it was completely different. I mean, 9 months. Normally you'd get maybe a week if you're lucky recording, you know, with, you know, Seafair or something like that. You'd get a week or 2 weeks. So we really, really got deep and in depth with this thing and spent all of our time and energy on it.
Let's talk about a couple of the singles.
Sure. High is probably the big one for me. And I'm your fool again. No explanation. Just tell me why. I've been fighting for a heart that was never mine. Give me a reason, or give me a light. If you're gonna let me down, I wanna get high. Hi and Alone, I wrote at home at like 3 a.m. I like woke up with the songs in my head. Some of the parts like that I recorded at home on the demo are still on it. Same with like Sleepwalking. Now that we're here, all that I fear is living without you. Waking a dream.
To say you love me, you don't need to stay till we make.
Love and Lo-Fi, which is really fun, was written by my co-write who truly believed in me and this project. And so the song is actually about believing that this can happen for us.
And it seems like every track there's some sort of theme, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you are tying some promotional things with the songs.
Yes.
Which I think is so interesting, and what artists I'm seeing are doing more and more now. Because, you know, music is something we're not really purchasing anymore. So can you talk about some of those collabs that you have going?
Sure. Coffee, 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 we did a Love and Lo-Fi drink that lasted for a couple months. Then we did a pie with Rude Food and Pie in Lakewood. And then we did Papers for High, Rolling Papers with Shway Papers. And I also donated for Forget Me Not, my single Forget Me Not. We decided to go and help as many sanctuaries and anti-poachers as we could. You've got your demons. Lastly, this last one is just for my album. It's with Saucy Brewworks, and it's called Damn Feelings, and it's a beer. It's like a 8% blood orange IPA because I wanted it to be very strong, you know, to represent the album.
So how do you make those partnerships? How does that come about?
You ask the question. You love a place so much. You say, hey, I've seen you before. Would you like to do something with me? Doing something as simple as a brand partnership in your hometown can really put eyes on both the local business and your music.
You worked for a long time at Gotta Groove Records.
Yes.
Pressing vinyl.
Yes, I loved it.
So that's going to be part of this too, because you're actually going to press your own record.
Yes, I'm partnering with Wax Mage. You know, they're part of Gotta Groove, and they just make these beautiful, beautiful pieces that you can also spin. So there's going to be lots of pinks, lots of sparkles, you know, all the stuff that encapsulates me in this record.
I love it. One thing I saw is that you converted to Judaism in 2017.
I did, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how that attaches to your identity?
Sure. So my manager and husband is Jewish. His father's a rabbi. His grandfather's a rabbi.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was one of those like no-brainer moments where I was like, I've always been interested in Judaism, but learning so much about it and the values, I was like, I'm sold. Let me do this. Yeah. So I studied for a year and hopped right in that water.
I do think it's great that you put all of that out there about yourself as part of who you are.
Oh,
also
thank
as part
you.
Of the LGBTQ community. And you're putting it all right
I'm
out
always
there.
Like, my name's Shayla Hope. I'm a pansexual Jew.
It's all part of the freeing process, I think.
It
for
is.
You. Yeah.
And I want other people to feel okay, too. I think that's like such a huge thing is like talking about, you know, like my song Alone is all about my abandonment issues. And instead of just saying, yeah, it's a relationship song, you know, I'm like, no, this is a thing about my abandonment issue. So people can feel closer and more connected. And maybe they're going through the same thing, you know, and they need an outlet, too.
What's next?
You know, we're getting on Hot AC Radio soon. But also I am already working on the next group of songs. And the thing about making music as well as a woman in her 30s. It's pretty crazy how many people will say, like, this could be on top 10, you know, Billboard, but your age is an impediment. That happens all the time. And that I'm not the exact look of, like, I'm not a Barbie. That's a whole thing as well. So this whole next group of songs is more about my anger towards the music industry and the people involved in it. And it's been really fun and therapeutic to be able to write songs like this.
So more songs coming.
More songs coming, baby.
Shayla, congrats and thanks so much.
Thank you. To say if we were together, would it ever really end? Oh, don't you sit here telling me how we could be just friends. And I ache most of the time. And when you call, I never know. Oh, don't you leave me alone.
Shayla Hope. Thank you, Amanda. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We are on Twitter as well, @SoundOfIdeas. Tomorrow on the program, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable with host Mike McIntyre. This week, he'll be joined by Ideastream reporters Gabriel Kramer and Abigail Botar, as well as Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau. Now, next week, I'll be joined on Monday by our Matt Richmond. We'll discuss what the Brady lists are and dig into how those lists are being used by the Cleveland Division of Police. Also next week, we hear from former Michael Stanley guitarist Mark Lee Shannon, who has a new book out, not about music. And we'll look at some reporting concerned with the return of Native American remains from museums across the region. If you missed any portion of this program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you again on Monday.